Hi everyone, and welcome to Season 3 of South African Expats. This show is sponsored by the family business, Luggage Warehouse. And if you look in the show notes, you'll find a discount coupon code to use on our Builder Set product, which is a product that lets you build your own set of luggage using any combination of sizes and colors of the same range, and you get more discounts the more bags you buy. Perfect if you're emigrating. That's it from me and Luggage Warehouse. Enjoy the show.
It could have been shorter. It could have been one page long where you just open it and it just says, ah! It's just kind of a summary of all of the terrible mistakes that I made so that people can skip over at least some of them.
What the British are like, and we can touch on it again a bit later.
They're hobbits, basically.
Okay.
That thing that it takes 3 years, I intend that to be reassuring rather than terrifying, but it is also terrifying.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to South African Expats, the show for immigration curious South Africans. I'm your host, Jonathan Varnker. This is episode 1 of season 3, and I couldn't have a better guest to start with this season. Sam Beck-Bessinger is the author of a book called Moving to the UK, A Concise Guide for South Africans. For more about Sam and her work, you can go to her website, the link is in the show notes, and you can also go to the community that she's building for South African expats in the UK called the Newcomers Club. All the relevant information will be in the show notes. What's most relevant in this interview is her obsession with spreadsheets, tick lists, to-do lists, and general clipboarding behavior. Sam has put together this book, which is a comprehensive guide for making the decision to move to the UK, everything it's going to take to get that done, and then everything to do once you get there on the other side. And I really, really do recommend and admire her book. If you're thinking about moving to the UK, I can't recommend it enough. So without further ado, here's Sam Beck-Bessinger, author of Moving to the UK. It's great to talk to you, Sam, about your experience and your book, Moving to the UK, which your publisher sent me, which is the first time that's happened. I felt a little thrilled there for a second.
Did it come with like goodies, like a whole goodie bag?
No, I just got the, well, I got an email and I said, yes, I'd love to interview her. And then I got the book in a courier package the next few days later.
You know, very fancy. Freebies. Very fancy.
It's more than enough. I gave it a cover to cover read in a couple of days, and what's interesting is that it feels like the summation of everything I've heard in two seasons of doing this show across different countries, not just the UK, but the reasons for moving, the push and the pull, the stresses and the emotional stuff that you write so well about. I think that's, I've lived overseas a couple of times, so I felt that too. And it really feels like a really tight, concise compendium of everything you need to know. So first of all, like, well done. Like, it's
Thank
a great
you.
Book.
It could have been shorter. It could have been one page long where you just open it and it just says,
Yes.
That would have been the more succinct version, but I think this is the second most succinct version of this book that I could have written. Yeah.
Right. Tonally, the mix of competent adult and scared child that you portray through your writing, because we all, you know, when faced with these, as you write, like big, hard decisions, no one grows up knowing how to do this stuff and it's scary. Mm.
My biggest summation of what it is like to move countries is that it's incredibly infantilizing, because you go from being a kind of mostly got your stuff together adult to suddenly not knowing how to do the most basic things, like how to see a doctor or how to buy groceries.
Yeah, the self-checkout queue story was good.
Oh my God, yeah. The time that I gave up on buying biscuits and ran out of a Tesco crying because I couldn't figure out how to buy them. Yeah, so it is. It's you have to learn all of these adulting skills all over again, which is kind of amazing, but also exhausting.
Yeah. Sticking very vaguely to the structure of this podcast, which is running up to the move and then after the move. Your book is structured in kind of a similar way because it just makes logical, chronological sense. So for the listeners then, it's divided into part one, deciding to move. Part two, the move itself, which has got an incredible amount of information. Part three, setting up your life. Part four, a path back to happiness, which is sounds pretty dire. and that's kind of the last part. But back to part three, setting up your new life. One thing I really appreciated was like the level of detail you've gone into on SIM cards, phones, you know, websites to find a place to live and all that kind of thing. Like it's, that must have taken some time.
So how the book happened is maybe kind of an interesting story. So I moved, I had the best sense of timing for my move of all time, which is that I moved in January 2020. So I had 3 weeks of normal life and then I got stuck in my house for 2 years. And I got COVID at some point quite badly. And I was totally man down. I was stuck in bed for about 2 weeks with terrible brain fog, couldn't work, couldn't think. And I was on deadline at the time. I was supposed to be working on my novel. But instead, what I started doing, as I'm sure everyone does, is I started making emotional support spreadsheets, which is kind of what I do. It's like when I'm feeling
right.
A bit sitchy,
I'm done with
I make
that.
Spreadsheets for fun. You do that too, right?
No. And
this spreadsheet was because my best friend was also moving to the UK a year after me. And I started making her a spreadsheet of it. It was basically this very overcomplicated to-do list of do this, do this, do this, do this. And what's great is, you know, when you write something for your best friend, I think you can be a little bit more of a dictator, right? Because you know them, you know what they want and what they need. So you can be very specific in your suggestions. Yeah. You know, it's not like go find a SIM card. It's go sign up for a Smarty SIM card, get the £10 one, you know, with all the links. And I worked on that spreadsheet for 2 weeks while I was in bed because I was too ill to do anything else. And that's kind of just what my brain likes to do, is sort of organize information when it's very weird. And at the end of the 2 weeks, I looked at it. And I at that point, I'd also started a document with additional information about all of the tasks. And I did a word count in the document and realized it was on like 30,000 words.
So wow.
I sent a very sheepish email to my agent saying, I know I'm supposed to be working on this entirely other book project, but how would you feel? I seem to have accidentally written a whole other book. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of this beautiful thing because, you know, I got to, it's really a gift. It's a gift that I made for my best friend and for all my other kind of, you know, best friends in the world who want to move. It is. It's just kind of a summary of all of the terrible mistakes that I made so that people can skip over at least some of them.
Well, why don't you tell me a little bit about the story about your mom?
So I think what I talk about in the first section about the decision to move is when a lot of people start off, you start off thinking, well, you know, I just need to make a pros and cons list and I can logic my way to the correct decision. And the thing is with a decision like this, there actually, as you say, there is no wrong choice. There is no math that will tell you if it's the right choice for you. And it means that if you talk to people who've moved and you ask them why they actually moved, very few people will tell you a rational pros and cons type reason. You know, they'll often have quite a personal, convoluted, often story about what actually eventually drove them. So for me and my partner, there were a bunch of pull reasons. So they were, you know, there were some rational things. I thought it'd be good for my career. My partner thought it'd be good for his career. But really kind of the big things were, as you say, one, my dad died, and you do all sorts of kind of weird, you make all sorts of strange decisions when you're grieving. And this was mine. The other thing is that my mum went blind in her 30s. And my mum, the biggest problem about going blind for my mum, who's generally dealt with it like an absolute pro, but the one thing that was very painful for her was the loss of her independence, particularly because, you know, my mum, her most beloved possession was this bright yellow mini that she had like a big, she had flowers all over the dashboard, and she used to drive that thing like a Ferrari. And so I think the hardest thing for her about losing her eyesight was just not being able to go anywhere by herself anymore.
Sure.
And I have the same genetic predisposition. So I probably will also lose my eyesight at some point.
You say probably in the book too. I mean, is there a statistical number on that, or is it just...
I mean, this is the thing. Like, I've spoken to a few different doctors about it. And, you know, also one of the complicated things is that medicine on this particular form of blindness is also evolving every year. So, I mean, who knows, really?
Sure.
But, I mean, not definitely, but there's a chance, a higher than average chance that I will lose my eyesight. And I actually avoided doing the genetic testing for years because I felt like, what's the point in knowing? Because there's nothing I can do about it. It's not a curable form of blindness, or at least it wasn't up until a couple of years ago. Now it looks like it kind of is getting there. It's the weird science. Anyway, but I realized a few years ago, and this was also triggered by my father dying, was there was something I could do about it, which is I could move to a country that has a good public transport system. And that's something that would mean that if I do lose my eyesight, it won't be as catastrophic for my independence as it was for my mom.
Yeah.
So that was kind of one of the big push factors for me. And it is, it's kind of, I think everyone that I've spoken to, who has all the South African friends I have who have washed up on this dreary island with me. If you really ask them, they often have these very personal, you know, deep emotional stories often. And it's because moving is really, really hard. Very few people do it on a whim, and very few people do it because of, you know, rational reasons.
Yeah. I mean, I found in interviewing quite a few people that, I guess it's the kind of show this is, that we don't delve into the emotions that hard. It's, you know, people will say I had a security concern or whatever it might be. But I know that the real reasons that those things happen are, I mean, a friend of mine got mugged and ended up in hospital for 4 days, and then he decided, no, I'm out of here. That's it. You know, so there's obviously a lot kind of behind the scenes. With regard to that deciding to move, you've got a whole block here in italics that I have highlighted. And I just wanted to, I was actually going to read it out, but since you're here and since I saw you hold up a copy of the book, it's on page 15.
Great.
And I wonder if you could do the audiobook version of it for me.
Okay, great. So this is a quote from a philosopher that I really love and admire, Ruth Chang. And it's her talking about how we actually have very few chances in our lives to make really difficult decisions that have a large impact on our life. And what she means by difficult decisions is a decision where there is no right or wrong answer. Okay. So it's here, in the space of hard choices, that we get to exercise our normative power, the power to create reasons for yourself, to make yourself into the kind of person for whom country living is preferable to the urban life. When we choose between options that are on a par, we can do something quite remarkable. We can put our very selves behind an option. Here's where I stand. Here's who I am. I'm for banking. I'm for chocolate donuts. This response in hard choices is a rational response, but it's not dictated by reasons given to us. Rather, it's supported by reasons created by us. When we create reasons for ourselves to become this kind of person rather than that, we wholeheartedly become the people that we are. You become yourself through hard choices. Hard choices are precious opportunities to celebrate what's special about the human condition. That's why hard choices are not a curse, but a godsend.
Right. So I love this quote, and I love this idea of, you know, hard choices are what lets you define who you are and gives you character, essentially. At the time of writing the book, you'd been living in the UK for 3 years. Is that now how long? Four? No, well,
it's three and a half. Yeah.
January 2020, right?
Yep.
Okay. So, I mean, how have you found that making a hard decision of moving has allowed you to redefine yourself as a person?
Oh, I love that question. In so deeply. I think it's been one of the most meaningful experiences of my life, in that it has produced so much meaning in terms of how I think about myself and how I think about the world, largely because it's been very hard. It's been very difficult. So there's a couple of things. I think the one is it has helped me understand things about myself that I didn't understand before. It's made me a much less anxious person overall, because I've realized that a lot of what used to make me feel anxious was feeling like I'd been so lucky in my life before, and worried that if any of those kind of pillars of my life broke, then I would be kind of lost in this void. And one of the things that moving has done is it's given me real respect for my own self-efficacy. It's given me, it's really helped me feel more secure in my own ability to create a good life for myself wherever I am.
Right.
Yeah.
So all those support structures that do get shaken when you move.
Exactly. Exactly. And I, you know, it's a real challenge to rebuild all of those things. But when you have had to rebuild them, you also are no longer so afraid of having to do so again.
Sure.
And that's actually been an extraordinary gift. It's also kind of, I think it's been wonderful for myself and my partner. I think going through something like this with someone that you love is either going to be the best or worst thing for your relationship.
Especially with 2 years of lockdown straight after.
Exactly. Moving. For ours, it's been magical. Okay. I only adore him more and more and more every day. less sure about my cat. He was a real liability for the whole experience. Lies. I love him to death. I think that's the one thing. I think it's also, you know, moving has helped me understand my own South Africanness in a new way. It's made me feel more South African,
right.
And understand more all the ways that I have been shaped by where I'm from, and appreciative of all of the things about me that are so South African that I think you only really see when you take a South African and dump them somewhere else, you know?
Sure. Can I interject there?
Yeah.
So as someone who's can't see the wood for the trees, right? As a South African who increasingly in these times as well feels like the national identity is confused, it's broken, the Rainbow Nation that's kind of gone now, and everyone's just like, what do we rally behind? The Rugby World Cup, you know, and like that. So, I mean, so from your position outside the country, like what do you think defines a South African? And I guess what especially the positive qualities, I suppose.
I mean, resilience, I think, is one of them. You know, I so often, I just think of that, like, you know, Burmaka Plun mentality, which has been something that has been so helpful for me here, but also just understanding how, in contrast, British people are they're these tiny, helpless little babies in a situation where they're left to their own devices. You
it's
know,
a good
I think
we don't
South
have
Africans,
British listeners.
I love the Brits, I really do, but they are very foreign and very strange. I think I've really come to appreciate South African resilience, which I think it's a shadow of the fact that we all of us have lived through such darkness and difficulty, but I think that's the upside. I think South Africans are also unbelievably open and kind as individuals, on average. I think it's also, I don't think we often really are able to comprehend how strange and complicated our history is, and how obviously we're all still living in the fallout of having lived through such a violent, weird, terrible, you know, last two centuries in this country. All those things become just very clear when you step out of the country for a minute. And, you know, as much as kind of the South African experiment is kind of, you know, it's having a moment of real and lack of clarity about what it means and where it's going. Just the fact that we are living through this incredible experiment in democracy, in reconciliation, in defining a nation, I get kind of misty eyed when I think about how beautiful that is, how beautiful that ideal is, that we're still figuring out.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, I've had many responses on the show about the edge, the little bit of danger, what's the quote from Game of Thrones? Chaos is a ladder. You write quite a lot about what the British are like, and we can touch on it again a bit later.
They're hobbits, basically.
Okay.
In a nutshell, they're just
analogy.
Hobbits.
Yeah. Okay, cool. South Africans in the workplace tend to be thought of as quite blunt, right?
Yes.
And they don't obey the proper social norms sometimes in terms of communication and all that kind of thing.
It's kind of, again, one of those things I feel incredibly grateful for, that I am a South African and I was shaped by South Africa, is if I think about my career, one of the things that really differentiates it from British friends who grew up in England is I have had such a huge diversity of work experiences in my life. Because in South Africa, there aren't really that many regulations and limits, you know. There's this real attitude of, you know, try it and see. And there's so much open space that if you want to start a podcast, or you want to write a book, or you want to do whatever, you know, shrug, just try, you know. And that's incredible. And it means that I have, you know, I feel like I've had about 30 different careers by now, in a way that's been really fun and stimulating. Whereas here, because everything has kind of been done, all paths have been trodden much more kind of deeply, you get funneled into pathways right. much more kind of strictly. And so people have much more linear careers, which can be good if that's the kind of person you are. But as someone who, you know, really enjoys, is very curious about a lot of things and probably slightly ADHD and kind of, you know, likes to pick up something and put it down and play.
Yeah, a starter, not necessarily a finisher.
Necessarily a completer, yeah.
Frustrate your publisher.
Exactly. ask my agent. I'm very grateful for that. Definitely, specifically friends I know who work in corporate spaces find they have had to learn a whole new communication style, just in terms of how British people speak. They really hedge everything. You really can't just say, hey, you said you were going to send that email. You didn't send that email. Please send that email. That is essentially a fireable sentence level of bluntness.
Okay.
That's equivalent to like throwing an egg in someone's face. Like, oh, how dare you? That is so aggressive. You'd have to kind of so obliquely come in and say, Jonathan, I know, I'm sure that you did. I feel so bad because I think I haven't checked my email inbox correctly. I'm so sorry that I obviously am confused about the fact that you said, I thought that you were going to send an email.
Right.
I'm still overplaying it. I'm still being too blunt, but you know what I mean? They're absurd. It's a whole different language.
Moving on to your section in the book about the process, the visa process and all that kind of thing. This is where you start, you know, the spreadsheets start coming and the tick lists and the to-dos and all that stuff, which I think as a practical guide is fantastic. In conversations with my wife, for example, about possibly immigrating to the UK, she's got a British visa. You know, we talk about where are we going to live? And I think for the majority of people, it's somewhere near London, but probably not in it, is kind of like the main thing. And your piece of advice here is live where your friends are.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done that?
My number one piece of advice. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think that like if you do have a choice, the single factor that should override every other factor is move as close to your friends as you possibly can. That's it. And it's for a few reasons. One, you know, I really think you can drive yourself nuts trying to identify the sort of perfect place to live in the UK. Right. I think this is something that happens with every decision you make when moving, is there are so few times in your life where you get to actually reset your entire life. And each of those choices you have to make is essentially an opportunity for you to totally reassess, like, what are my needs for this thing? What do I actually want? What is actually the car that really defines me, you know? And this is the problem, is that these choices, there are too many choices. And it can be incredibly paralyzing trying to make objectively the correct choice for each of those choices. Specifically, the where do you live one feels like a very loaded, very important choice. And it's one that I've seen a few friends just get very stuck on and go down information research holes and rabbit holes and get quite stuck. So it's a good way to shortcut that choice, because presumably you are quite similar to your friends, and a great way to kind of just, you know, make this decision easily is to say, my friends probably had reasons for choosing this place. Let me go just make the same choice.
Nice. Lazy. I like it.
That's kind of the first one. And the second thing is just, you know, those first few months particularly are so, so lonely and so isolating. And just having a crack that you can get into so that you can meet other people, just one into a community makes so much difference. It really can just be like one person makes everything better. What we did is we literally made a Google map of all of our friends and where all of them live. And we moved to the highest density of dots. And it's worked out great. I highly, highly recommend it. Although it does mean we have ended up living in London and paying through our eyeballs for a mortgage.
Right.
But it has, you know, so our first 2 years as a comparison where we lived in Cambridge, it's difficult for me to compare because there were COVID years, but we knew no one in Cambridge. And it was so difficult getting to make those first few friends. Once you've made a few friends, it's much, much easier. But it took months for us to really just feel like we had any community in Cambridge at all, versus, you know, we eventually gave up, moved to London. And, you know, that night because we have so many friends already living in London, we were already kind of had our social calendars booked for the next few months and didn't feel didn't feel so uprooted anymore. It made such a difference for us. And it's been my number one tip for everyone else. Move as close to your friends as you can.
Okay. And I imagine, I mean, those first few social outings with your friends, I imagine that is going to a pub and then not believing how much the drinks cost. Is that,
oh my God,
is that like a good first 3 months of being a South African in London?
It's a good first 3 years. I still, I mean, you very quickly learn you just can't actually convert stuff back.
Yeah.
So there's a great cost of living calculator. I'm sure it's been mentioned before on the show, called Numbeo, which
it
lets you.
Numbeo.
Oh, okay. So it's a great, if you're trying to work out kind of how your cost of living will change, you plug in your current city and you plug in the city that you're thinking about, and it will show you kind of the difference as a percentage of what things cost. And what melts your brain is that the UK in general, but particularly London, the cost of stuff like food and eating out, anything where there's a service element, particularly, it's often, you know, it's twice as expensive. However, if you take into account the fact how much more salaries are higher, overall, you tend to be financially better off by moving to the UK on average. But it means that you have to very quickly stop converting, because the cost of a pint of beer will make you never leave your house again.
Right.
Yeah.
So just on that, on standard of living, you mention, there's a moment in the book where you mention that for those of you who are used to a relatively privileged lifestyle, kind of upper end of the economic spectrum, you will be taking a step down. If you are, you know, if you are not that, if you are, I guess, middle class, as it were, in South Africa, then you're going to take a step up when you go to the UK. Can you talk a bit about that?
Totally. So I think that this is something, one of the other things that becomes very clear about South Africa, more clear about South Africa when you leave South Africa, is just how disgustingly unequal a country, an economy South Africa has, and how different that is to the rest of the world. And it's one of those things that I think we know that as South Africans, but when it's just so clear, I think, when you leave, how much it distorts our ways of thinking. So it's hard to give one-to-one comparisons, because your life when you move, regardless of where in the socioeconomic spectrum you started, your life will get better in some ways and worse in other ways. So no matter how rich or middle class you were in South Africa, you will probably live in a smaller house if you move to the UK. That's kind of one thing. However, you probably will improve your personal safety. And then it's a question of, you know, how do you value those two things? And that's a very personal question for people.
Sure.
So I think this is one of the things. However, what I have seen from people moving to the UK is that if you were in the top 1% of South Africans in that economy and you move, so firstly, if you have a personal monthly income of 50,000 rand a month in South Africa, that's, you're in the top 1%. That same income in the UK puts you in the top half. Right.
Okay.
So just as your sense of like relative income, you'll immediately go from feeling like you're doing great to feeling like you are very in the middle. Right. And that's just a psychological thing that is takes some getting used to.
Sure.
But then also, you know, I think in terms of the quality of life that people can have in South Africa, if you can afford to basically shift yourself to only using private services, so you can afford to send your kids to good private schools, you can afford private medical aid, you can afford private security, you can essentially, and you can live in like a, you know, a beautiful estate, you can essentially live a better quality of life than the average person in a developed country, right? Like private medical aid, or private medical hospitals and clinics in South Africa are better than the NHS. Your experience is lovely. It's incredible. And I would argue that private schools in South Africa, many of them also feel, you know, better than state schools and many, the average state school in the UK. So really the people who have the most to gain by moving out of South Africa to a country like the UK are people who are struggling to afford private versions of all of those things.
Right.
Or people who are struggling to get a job in South Africa. That's the other kind of major thing, is that the unemployment rate in South Africa, I think, is close to 47% now, the wider definition.
Expanded definition, yeah.
And in the UK, it's 4%, you know. So I think that we frame the question like, you know, we frame the question, will you be financially better off if you move, as though there's a single answer, But I think the truth is that it really depends where you are in South Africa, South Africa's economy,
sure,
how much your life will change.
Well, I think that's a pretty illustrative answer for anyone listening as to, you know, where do you consider yourself on that spectrum? And, you know, for example, my brother and his family immigrated a couple of years ago, and his kids were in private school and they all had private medical care and all that kind of thing. But with the pandemic and the fact that that the family business was travel, was luggage, you know, they took a hit, and it was, you know, we can't afford this lifestyle here anymore. Yeah. This is tangential ad break. This show is supported by Luggage Warehouse, my family company, my family's business. So if you're thinking about emigrating, go get some luggage there. Okay, that's the ad break.
I do have a whole thing about why you probably want to pay for an extra suitcase to take on the flight.
Oh, yes, yes. In terms of allowance and shipping.
You go buy some luggage.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so suffice to say that when it comes to the pre-moving operation, Sam has provided like a great list. There's a Gantt chart is mentioned, so you know it's hectic.
That's the level of fanciness we're talking about. And just to say that that spreadsheet or that to-do list is available for free online. So if you don't want to buy the book, that's also fine. There's like, please just go in and find the spreadsheet on the internet and enjoy it with my love.
So that's at sambeckbessinger.com, or is that at the Newcomers Club?
That is on the Newcomers Club, which is the kind of online community that I am trying to launch around the book. Yeah,
sure. There'll be a link in the show notes to that, and we'll chat about it a little bit later. But we get to the setting up your new life, right? And this is where, like, if you are serious about moving, then this is the tick list. This is the first week, first month, first year, you know, everything laid out on a painful level of detail. Suffice to say, that stuff is all awesome, but beyond the purview of a conversation. Okay, then, so let's shift forward then to the cultural, the emotional side of it, of becoming a bit British. We've chatted a little bit about what being a bit British is, and I've spoken to Zoe Pedersen, who she and her husband moved south of London, and, you know, their thing was that when winter comes, you know, you get your vitamin D lamps and you kind of lean into it hard with hot chocolate and books by the fire and all that kind of thing. So
eat pies.
Right. another digression. Rhubarb pie is literally the best thing in the world. Or crumble.
It's so
perhaps.
Good. Yeah. So good. Oh.
Can't find rhubarb in South Africa. But when it comes to becoming a bit British, like, what are the ways in which you've done that? And what are some of the best parts about being British, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I think you said it well, which is that the key to being happy in a new country is not to try to be happy in the same way. Never try to just recapture the life that you had before, because it's a different country, and you kind of have to learn to love it on its own merits for its own charms. The things for me that I have absolutely fallen in love with, I have come to love having four seasons. One of my favorite things to write in the book was I wrote a little almanac, so a little calendar of month by month. Thank you. Here are the things that I love about each month in the UK. I do love that it's your life has to adapt to the season so much, because you can't just, you know, keep going for hikes and runs in winter. It's dark all the time. So you have to find different ways of being active, different ways of interacting with your friends. All those things are lovely. I have also come to really love how strange small town village customs are in the UK. Like, they're actually like, they're a deeply pagan pagan culture in a way that I don't think I fully understood. And I also don't think I really understood how every village in the UK has its own cultural history and legacy and traditions entirely. So some of my favorite kind of weekends away have been picking a random village on a weekend where they're having some village fete or some, like, the eel festival,
right?
Or, you know, the day where everyone dresses up like a horse and then rolls barrels down the hill. I mean, they do weird stuff. There's weird stuff happening in England. You don't even know. And just leaning into that weirdness. Like, I love that. I really love London, and like leaning into London's weirdness is a whole other flavor of weird. I live in Hackney, which is, I think, the epicenter of strange.
Right.
We play a game, which is my partner and I, which is Weirdo of the Week. So who is the strangest person we have seen every week? Last week's winner we'd met the winner, who was a person on a unicycle with an extra long hockey stick going through the park. And we were like, hello, are you playing unicycle hockey? And he said, yeah, we meet once a week to play unicycle hockey. So I was like, cool, Weirdo of the Week. But then he was surpassed the very next morning as we were walking down our street, and we saw a man probably in his 80s with like a waist length beard, who was taking his pet out for a walk, showing his pets the trees on the street. And his pet was a very fat chicken sitting on his shoulder.
Awesome.
So I mean, you know, love the weirdos.
Yeah.
The weird that I love in London is, you know, endless kind of obscure music things where it's, you know, it's like a Swedish reggae act, you know, is kind of playing in a basement. That kind of stuff has been delightful.
Right.
You've got to find what you love about the UK. For me, it's the weirdos.
Sure. So we've got two more things after this to talk about, but just very quickly on the weather, because it looks quite sunny. I don't know whether you've got like mad lights in your house or what's going on there.
It's a lie. It's been raining for 3 days.
Okay. But on average, I mean, I know you have kind of three, almost 4 years of reference, right? But it feels to me, sitting on the outside, having watched, you know, listened to weather reports over the last couple of years and all that, that because of climate change, for example, suddenly England is making the best champagne. The heat is shifting into England. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, when you hear the UK people complain about, oh, it's 37 degrees today, and you're like, that's not supposed to happen. That was 20 years ago. That would never happen. So do you feel like, is there a change happening to British climate that makes it more palatable for South Africans?
Absolutely. I mean, this is kind of one of the deeply unjust things about the world, right? Like, the UK historically is one of the largest emitters of climate change chemicals and gases, and yet is one of the countries that, you know, directly as a result of that, one, is the best positioned to weather the changes to the climate by building, you know, storm shelter thingies and I don't know, by adapting.
Still have water security while heating up.
Exactly. And also, even more outrageously, is kind of benefiting. So absolutely, summers are delightful. This summer was a little bit miserable. We didn't have as many kind of weeks of solid, reliable 30 degree weather, but every other year I've been here, we've had absolutely glorious summers.
Right.
You also have the benefit of the sun only setting after 9 p.m., which means that you have a whole bonus day after your work day, which is like an extra day just for fun.
It's madness.
It's great. Like, I mean, people get nothing done in summer. You just drink Aperol Spritz every day on a canal with your friends. It's delightful.
Right.
It's not entirely all good. The stuff I've read about this, and I'm not obviously a climate specialist, but I have read stuff that suggests that the extremes are going to get more extreme. So summers will get hotter and winters will get colder because of how it will disrupt the Gulf Stream.
Yeah, sure.
It's not entirely just like, yay, it's all more pleasant. But certainly, you know, one of the other places my partner and I were considering moving to was Spain. And looking at, you know, the kind of heat waves that southern Spain has dealt with over the last couple of years, I think that's just going to be an increasingly difficult place to live.
Yeah.
South Africa obviously has dealt with a decade of droughts that are only going to get worse. Definitely is a factor that specifically southern England, the weather is not as bad as you think.
Right.
The darkness is more what gets to you, the darkness and the kind of gray. But again, there are ways that you learn to deal with it.
Sure. It does feel like even with extremities, like the extreme of it getting cold is that England has more snow in a very picturesque British way.
Yeah, completely. Exactly.
Unfair.
I know.
Okay, so two more things. in right on page 230 near the end of the book, you talk about it just takes time. And you quotes Terry, a South African you spoke to who lived in the UK for 12 years. And the key line is there, it takes 3 years. And my friend who lived in London for almost 10 years said it took him 5 years to feel like he was a part of London, like he belonged there, right? Can you, like, do you have any additional context on that or stories?
So, I mean, just to say that thing that it takes 3 years, I intend that to be reassuring rather than terrifying, but it is also terrifying because I think that that is the truth, is it will take a long time, longer than you think, before a new country will feel like your home in any kind of real way. It took me about 9 months, I would say, before moving was no longer kind of the biggest project that I was engaged in. I wasn't like actively trying to figure out how to do things anymore. Right. That took about 9 months before I could like get back to my life. But it took, for me, it took 3 years, and many of the other people I spoke to. So Terry was one who said it, but it was something I actually heard echoed again and again, sometimes five, you know, some people it takes longer. There were very few people I spoke to who said, oh yeah, a year. And then I felt like I'd always lived there, you know, because it just, moving countries really requires you to reassess your identity, rebuild your identity from the ground up in so many different ways. It takes you time to learn how to be happy, to learn this is how to make friends, this is how to enjoy the weather, this is how to, you know, bake rhubarb pie. All of those things take time. And it's not to say that those 3 years will be entirely miserable. It's just to say that it won't yet feel like home. You will still feel quite unsettled in quite a deep way.
Yeah.
But it, for most people, it does eventually change. Not for everyone, right? Like, and I think one of the things that helped me when my partner and I were, had been dithering about, should we make this decision for a long time, was getting to the point where we realized it's okay also if we go for a few years and then come back, because going and coming back isn't the same thing as never going. That's also okay. Because you will still get all of the things that you want out of that experience. You will still have learned, you still would have moved, you know, and you can still always choose to come back. South Africa will still be there.
Yeah. And it is astonishingly, maybe not in the, you know, the bureaucratic way, but emotionally, I lived in Japan for 5 years. And when I came home, I always thought, you know, Japan's going to change me. I'm not going to wear shoes in the house, all that stuff. Like the moment I got home, I just walked into the house with shoes and just discarded everything that I've learned in Japan. It was terrible. I feel like South Africans have this because of the resilience thing. Mm. The other edge on that sword is like, I'm a loser if I don't make it work, you know?
Yeah.
Like I will have failed if I decide I don't like it and want to come home, you know, which I think is dangerous.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the thing is as well that home will always be home, right? So now I, you know, 3.5 years in, I really do feel like London is home. Like I feel like when I come back to London, I'm really excited to get back into my life. I now think part of my self-identity also is I'm a Londoner. I have fallen in love with the city in a way that it, you know, because of also that thing about how I made a choice, that's now part of how I think about myself as someone who chose London, who has built my life here around London.
Sure.
But when I go back home, I've just come back from Cape Town. I feel like I'm coming home also. So I don't feel like South Africa is no longer my home. I now feel that I have two homes, and that's, you know, sometimes you feel a bit torn in two because you have people you love in both places, but mostly I feel just so, my life has been so enriched by that experience, by getting to think of myself in two ways and getting to love two places.
Sure, sure. So lastly, you know, just because we were talking about it takes 3 years and a big portion of that is, and, you know, moving close to your friends and all that and building a community, fine, as you put it, kind of like building, learning to be happy again and building your life again and all that. Let's talk about like what you're trying to do with the Newcomers Club. And, you know, I also like to know on a personal side, have you, you know, made connections through that club that have turned into like actual human space meetings?
Yes, we have. So, I only started the club a couple of months ago. We're still experimenting, trying to find the right platform for it, the right formats. Basically, I started it because my first 2 years, especially when we lived in Cambridge, we didn't know a single human soul. It was so isolated. I want to help other people, basically, who are fresh in the UK, who might not already have a big friendship network, because I really do feel you need one friend, and then it's easier because you'll meet other people through those people. So far, we've just had one in-person meetup, which was in summer. So it was July. No, it was August. Yeah, August. It was in London. I met some new people I hadn't met before, who were all absolutely lovely. They met each other. I know that at least two of the connections that were made at that picnic, they're continuing to hang out, which makes me very happy. Awesome. Yeah, it's and we just want to kind of grow it, really. So I'm hoping that in time it won't just be South Africans, because, you know, it was helpful for me to meet other newcomers from all around the world, not only from South Africa. Right now we're all South Africans. That's also great. Yeah, I'm just hoping in time there's a website which I'm hoping will be a really helpful set of resources. There's so much research that you have to do when moving. It seems absurd to me that everyone has to do the research over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, it's partly what I was attempting to do in the book, but I mean, obviously the thing with the physical paper book is things go out of date really quickly. Mm-hmm. So having an online encyclopedia, essentially, which is here's everything you need, here's all the links in one place. Yeah, I'm hoping it just becomes this kind of living community resource.
Sure.
So that other people have a slightly easier time than I did.
Right. I mean, the pinned post here is every single link in the book in one place. That's in the home. That's on the home space there.
Yep.
And I mean, look, the URL is community.newcomers-club.com/home. But what's the most effective Google search to find it?
Actually, the easiest thing to do is to go to my website, which is sambigmessenger.com. And then right at the top of that is a link to the book and and the Newcomers Club.
Awesome.
And the book.
I think I have learned and covered everything I wanted to hear from you today. Thank you so much for your time and for writing this. I hope anyone thinking about moving to the UK will at least pick it up in the store or have a look online. It's where can you find the book? What are some of the outlets?
It's in basically every bookshop in South Africa. So it's at Exclusive Books, it's at Bargain Books, it's at most of the indies. I've seen the Book Lounge has it in Cape Town. Love Books has it in Joburg. Yeah, it's all over. Can't escape me. I think it's also on Takealot, I think, if you're an online person.
Right. Although not the ideal book perhaps for an audiobook / extended podcast. So too many links.
I've never heard a good audio spreadsheet.
Audio spreadsheet, right? Yeah. Column 3, row 4. Absolutely. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sam. I really enjoyed the conversation.
It was really good. Thanks.